This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hi, this is Javon, your Blinds.com design consultant.
Oh, wow. A real person.
Yep. I'm here to help with everything from selecting the perfect window treatments to...
Well, I've got a complicated project.
No problem. We make the complex simple. I can even help schedule a professional measure and install.
I didn't realize you did that.
We can also send you samples fast and free.
Wow. I mean, I always thought I needed a designer to come to my home, but scheduling's always a nightmare.
Not with Blinds.com. We're on your schedule, and there's no haggling, pressure, or hidden fees either.
I just might have to do more.
Whatever you need. How about you tell me what you had in mind?
Okay, then. So the first room we're looking at is for guests coming over, and I'm thinking of something...
Blinds.com has covered over 25 million windows, all backed by a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com now and get up to 40% off with minimum purchase. Rules and restrictions may apply.
True North stores have Primo Eats and Pepsi brand products that are heavy on taste and light on your wallet. Right now, buy any Primo sandwich and add a 20-ounce Pepsi brand beverage for just $1. Handmade every day, Primo uses quality meats and cheeses. Complete the meal with a Pepsi. Grab any Primo sandwich and pair it with a 20-ounce Pepsi brand beverage for just $1. Get more with the True Rewards mobile app. Available in your app store. True North convenience stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Hey, it's Jim Costa with Cash the Ticket. Mike Valeni and I are all over the tournament again this March. Breakdowns of every region and every game, who are the Cinderellas, and which team's cutting down the nets. Subscribe and listen to Cash the Ticket on the Odyssey app, wherever you get your podcasts.
Right now, let's talk to BMAC, Brian McFadden, two-time Super Bowl champion, NFL analyst for CBS Sports, does a terrific podcast as well. BMAC, I want to ask you about all the hoopla surrounding Shedeur Sanders. His dad today lands a $54 million extension in Colorado, and I'm just not buying all of the naysayers and the stuff that I'm hearing about Shedeur. For me, and I've said this to Mike, I have him as my top quarterback. I know Cam is getting all the love, and he's probably going to be the first guy taken. But this kid completed, 71 or 73% of his passes over the 2 years that he was in Colorado, led the nation in that category, threw for over 4,000 yards, Big 12 Offensive Player of the Year, blah, blah, blah. What more does this kid have to do? What's going on here?
And don't forget to mention he did all of that. He excelled with no offensive line production. None in terms of blocking, being consistent, working from within a comfortable pocket. He never had that luxury. And because his offensive line was so bad in protecting him, they also weren't great in running the football. But he still delivered to the numbers that you just mentioned. So that's the thing that I'm confused about too, guys. Honestly, how can a player lose draft leverage when no games are being played? I thought it was about what you've done throughout the season, which gives you an opportunity to put a confirmation on your pre-draft process in terms of the workouts and things like that in the meetings. But this is a player, for some reason, he's losing draft leverage after games are done. He's done everything you would want your quarterback to do plus more. And I look at all the notable quarterbacks that we're talking about in terms of, being drafted high. You look at the Cam Wards of the world and Jackson Dart and Tyler and all these other names. Name me another quarterback that has been had to be comfortable being uncomfortable like Shedeur Sanders. None. So everything they're throwing at him, these are false narratives that are not right and that they're not fair for him because he's done everything you would want a quarterback to do plus more. And last time I checked, since the season has ended, he hasn't been involved in anything in terms of law enforcement. He hasn't been involved in any type of scandal. He's done everything he's supposed to be doing, but yet and still he's losing draft leverage.
Well, Michael Williams is apparently losing some draft leverage in some of these mock drafts, and this perception for whatever reason. I get it. It's frustrating because you feel like maybe there's some attitudes against his dad. And who knows with some of these OGs that are still running the NFL. But we talked about it. Remember with Lamar Jackson? Remember Bill Polian was kind of being very cryptic about, well, what are you saying? Is he not smart enough to be quarterback? The guy's an amazing athlete. Meanwhile, B, you've seen this. These knuckleheads who keep their jobs or they get fired and get another job, they lock on a guy like Mitchell Trubisky because they love the size.
Come on.
Right?
Come
and the
on.
Guy never won
Come
jack.
On. Hey. Hey, Mike, you saying you're talking too much good stuff right now. Don't do that. They might mute you. To your point, Trubisky was drafted top three. Trubisky wasn't even the best quarterback in the ACC.
Right.
In the ACC. But because he was well-liked, he was a fan favorite, they pushed him. They gave him a positive narrative. They tried to take the narrative, the positivity away from Lamar Jackson, and he's still making organizations pay for it. Don't forget, Lamar Jackson had to go through that false narrative two times.
Yep.
Coming out
yep.
from Louisville, where he really exceeded, did more with less, won a Heisman, didn't go until the end of the first round. They wanted him to trade to change positions. And then when he tried to force his way out because they were not willing to pay him the amount of money that he was trying to get, all the other teams say publicly, we're not entertaining Lamar Jackson. We would not trade for Lamar Jackson. Something that we've never seen done in free agency, where teams verbally
collusion.
Came out and said we wouldn't want him to be a part of our team.
Right.
Yeah. B, listen. It's going to be interesting to see how it all shakes out. Let's talk about some of the things that have already happened in the quarterback market. It's Bryant McFadden joining us here on Dukes and Bell as we talk all things NFL. What's Russ going to do with the Giants, man? I mean, he's already in New York. He's at Nick games. He's throwing footballs to fans. You're like, okay. I don't think it's a good team right now. I don't think that we're going to see him, exceed expectations. But they've signed Jameis and Russ now. What are the Giants going to do?
Well, for Russ, he can care less. He's just happy that a team would love for him to potentially be a starting quarterback. No question, that's not a playoff-caliber team. But it's a great situation for Russ because he can continue to play and also be a starter. What will the Giants do? Well, this season, you shouldn't have any high expectations for them overall, right? But adding Russell Wilson along to what they already had with Jameis Winston, it provides them flexibility at three, right? Because let's say, hypothetically speaking, Cam Ward and Shedeur Sanders, they're off the board. Now you potentially could move out of three, move back, get a few extra picks, and draft another position of need, or stay there at three, and you still got two high-level players right there for the picking in Abdul Carter or Travis Hunter. So this move, in my opinion, it provides flexibility because I still do believe they could, if Cam Ward or if Shedeur Sanders is there at three, you draft either or. Now, you said earlier, and I agree with you, Cam Ward is looking like the top quarterback to come off the board. But if that's the reality, you still can go get a guy like Shedeur Sanders. So I think this is a move for the Giants to provide flexibility in terms of what they could do at number three when the draft kicks off.
We've heard the comments from Cameron Hayward about Aaron Rodgers. He's walked some of that back as we're talking to Bryant McFadden, a former two-time Super Bowl winner with the Steelers. But the Aaron Rodgers thing, you think he's going to alienate, the Steelers, the organization, let alone the players, by trying to maybe leverage this Minnesota thing? That we keep hearing about Minnesota maybe wants to say, you know what, J.J. McCarthy's our guy of the future, but he's still not as good as Aaron Rodgers right now, even at his advanced stage of his career. Is Aaron Rodgers going to milk this until the draft or beyond?
Unfortunately, I think he could. I don't know if he will, but I think that's a legit possibility. And my thing is this, if you're Aaron Rodgers, number one, guys, Mike Carr, if you're Aaron Rodgers, if you legit want to play football this season and you're not really entertaining retiring, make your decision now. Because look, we're almost in the month of April. Wherever he goes, it will be a new playbook he has to get acclimated to. It will be a new group of guys he's playing with. Chemistry is very, very important. And if you remember, he didn't spend a lot of time with his Jets teammates during the offseason, right? He attended some workouts, but remember there was a big hoopla with him not being there for mandatory minicamp. His presence is very, very important, especially to a new organization. So the faster he makes his decision made, which clearly is the team in Pennsylvania that really wants him, go ahead and get acclimated to the new playbook, the new schemes that you'll be a part of. And when it comes to this Minnesota thing, Minnesota don't want Aaron Rodgers. They don't want him. Because if they wanted him, he would be a Minnesota Viking. They're okay in giving the keys to J.J. McCarthy. And the thing is, they're going to allow J.J. McCarthy to have his due process. He's going to get every opportunity to show that either he's ready or he's not ready. But by that time, training camp will be here. Preseason will be here. So hopefully, if you're Aaron Rodgers, you already made your decision known, especially if you would like to play.
We asked you about these corners. We keep getting back to the Falcons, and then I want to ask you about Cousins here. But we've been saying, Will Johnson, I believe the kid's name is, out of Michigan, is considered to be the best corner in some people's, estimation. I really like Jahdae Barron out of Texas, ran a 4.3. I was telling the Mike yesterday, kid has all the intangibles. But I would not be upset if the Falcons went that route because, again, it is a position of need. Mm-hmm. Mike says, "Well, then why the heck did you pay one of your guys $18 million to bring him back? What are we doing here? I want your evaluation on the corners."
Well, cornerback for me should be a dire need for the Falcons. You know, you need to have as many athletic guys in the secondary to cover some of these premier athletes on the offensive end. And A.J. Terrell is that guy, but outside of A.J. Terrell, you've been still trying to figure things out. You know, you look at bringing Mike Hughes back, I kind of see him more so of an inside guy than an outside guy.
Okay.
In terms of the top cornerbacks, wow, I like Jahdae Barron as well. The thing for me when it comes to Will Johnson, I need to see Will run. I need to see him run. Like,
okay.
When you play cornerback, you cannot be in the category of the top guy, and you don't run a 40 at all. I need that. That's very, very important. That's super important. Jahdae went to the Indy and ran 4.3. As of right now, we haven't heard. I think Will is supposed to have his own personal per day, if I'm not mistaken, in early April. But I need to see him run. But outside of that, Jahdae Barron he's garnished a lot of traction, deserving so. Trey Amos from Mississippi, 6'1", 195. He's going to be a first-round player as well, first-round corner. Suvon Revo, now he's dealing with the injury from East Carolina. He tore his ACL, I think, in early September of a year ago. But he's a guy, in my opinion, guys, if he was healthy, he would be the number one corner. No arguments, axed. You can't get in that debate. I think he would be the number one corner. A.Z. Thomas from Florida State. Now, granted, I don't see him going as high as where the Falcons are slated in the first round, but I think he's a first-round type talent as well. So and I'll say this, too. In terms of second-round value, guys, there are quite a few names in the second round that I think could be big-time, high-level players at the cornerback position as second-round potential top talent. One guy who I really, really love is the kid from Iowa State. Darian Porter, I think that's his name, from Iowa State. I really love his game. Yeah, Darian Porter, 6'3", around 190. He ran high 4.3 at the Combine in Indy. And they've done a really, really good job in producing big-time players at the cornerback position from Iowa State. So that's a second-round name that could be there for Atlanta in the second round if they don't decide to attack the cornerback position in the first round.
All right, big guy. I know we've talked about Mike Hughes at the corner opposite A.J. Terrell. Whoever's going to plugs in immediately as a nickel. But we still think we got to have that long-term answer.
Well, he just said he thought Hughes is an inside guy. That's
right.
What he was saying. Hughes is an inside guy, and if they draft a corner,
he goes opposite A.J.?
Yeah.
That would be nice, but we're paying Mike Hughes for that kind of role, which makes sense.
Let me ask you this, B-Mac, before we let you go. If Rodgers sits out in 2025 or retires, could the Steelers pursue Cousins?
Hey, I've already been on X, kind of throwing that out into the atmosphere to Steeler Nation. Because right now we only have Mason Rudolph as a notable potential starting option. That's it. If Rodgers happens to retire and none of these quarterbacks fall, especially in the first round, if I'm Pittsburgh, I throw out a late-round pick to Atlanta for Kirk Cousins, in my opinion. Because I don't know if you want to go into this season where – every year is playoff aspirations for Pittsburgh, right? Every year. Do you really believe Mason Rudolph can get you to another playoff opportunity as a full-time starter? I'm not quite ready to say that. I would throw out a late flyer, late-round pick to Atlanta for Kirk Cousins, no question. And I would have Kirk Cousins as a starting quarterback for Pittsburgh, in my opinion. Yes, I would welcome that if Aaron Rodgers decides to call it quits or just does not want to be a Pittsburgh Steeler.
But both Aaron Rodgers and Kirk Cousins, I know we got a breaker, they're so passive-aggressive. He doesn't want anybody over his shoulder. Any team he could possibly go to, they're going to have Bryant, a quarterback drafted, whether it's Jalen Milroe in the case of the Steelers. There'll be somebody that the fans will be wanting to see.
Well, at this point, Mike, Carl, in Kirk Cousins' career, he understands where he is. He's not a bona fide starter anymore in terms of the future. So
does
this
he
is
though?
A trial by error process, and yeah. I think humility will sit in for him and understanding. You know what? What happened last year in Atlanta, didn't play my best, eventually got benched. Phoenix took over. I know what my role is. But if you're telling me, Pittsburgh, that it's my job to lose for this season, right, and even if you do draft a guy, 9 times out of 10, when he is in the saddle, I'm no longer here anyway. I welcome that because, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, it seems like Kirk Cousins still believes he could play this year.
Yes, he does.
Yep.
Yes,
right?
He does.
So if that's the case, and if Pittsburgh is in a situation to what you guys presented to me, Aaron Rodgers is no longer in the picture. You only have Mason Rudolph. If you're Kirk Cousins, you believe you can play in front of Mason Rudolph. And if you're the starter, it's your job to hold on to that position, regardless who they might draft early at the quarterback position in this upcoming year's draft.
All right, Joe. Our 92.9 The Game Falcons insider, Joe Patrick, joins us every Friday at 12:20. We'll probably get to some Atlanta United stuff here as well, but we got to get your thoughts on Chipotle Gate, Joe. Kirk Cousins is at the Cleveland Chipotle. What are your thoughts?
I retweeted it. I thought it was interesting that he was there, but apparently his agent kind of like was regretful of the fact that apparently it had nothing to do. But hey, who knows? You know, Chipotle is it's a good spot. Bo was telling me I have to have my spiciest Chipotle take ready for you guys, and it's not related to Kirk Cousins at all. But I gotta say, I gotta admit, and I think I can admit it because I believe the statute of limitations would have passed by now. Because this probably would have been it was pre-pandemic sometime, but have just selfishly taken a bottle of the green Tabasco sauce home with me from the Chipotle. like not a mistake.
Let me get that bucks.
Yeah. So I figure, hey, they're gonna throw it away eventually. So you know, I'll just get to the bottom of this bottle here.
I don't think they were gonna throw it away. I think people were gonna use it and they were gonna refill it.
That's very selfish.
Yeah. So you're just thieving green Tabasco sauce. Okay, that's not surprising to me at all.
Very, very selfish.
So they're saying he's just in Cleveland just to be there, just for fun?
I guess so. I mean, that was kind of, you know, I believe it was his agent, Mike McCartney, who said something. I believe like Ian Rappaport was kind of taking blame for having retweeted the image at some point or sharing the image around that really made it pop off. And I believe that either he or Mike McCartney, I think they were talking a little bit and exchanging a little bit on Twitter. And yeah, there was, I guess it was unrelated, but I don't know. I don't know, guys. I don't think anything is unrelated these days.
No, especially with that guy.
Yeah. Neither do I.
Especially that guy. They wanted, wanted that honestly, picture to be seen in Cleveland. Because if they ass was in Nova Scotia, you wouldn't have seen it.
Right?
Yeah.
At this point, like I think like all of our antenna are up with everything, you know, all the signals that are kind of being sent. And I retweeted it just because it's like, hey, you know, like it's out there, you know, let's, you know, see how the public responds to this and how Kirk responds to this. So I just felt like, you know, he doesn't respond to many tweets or even put many personal tweets out there, and that was one of them. So I thought it was at least relevant, but apparently not. But we'll see.
Yeah, I don't. I'm with you. I kind of buy it as fishy as well. But it's also like, you know, I mean, he lives here. I haven't seen anybody post any pictures of or seeing him around. I mean, he lives in Atlanta, and he pops up in Cleveland. I haven't heard from him or really seen him since the Super Bowl. So, I don't know.
Whatever.
Anyway, he was putting that shirt over his Falcon shirt, apparently, at the ping pong party.
That told y'all you needed. Hey, Joe, it's no shock or surprise when kickers are signed in the offseason, right? But when you look at this guy, and I love his name, Lenny. I'm a big Lenny.
Lenny Craig, right?
I'm a big Lenny.
Lenny Craig.
You call him Lenny the Leg.
But they signed to a multiple-year deal, Joe. Is this something – they ain't signing to be a damn kickoff specialist. It don't look like he's no punter. So what is that signing of Lenny? What does that tell you?
I think it tells you that they like him a lot, and he might be this team's kicker next year. I mean, kickers can come from anywhere. And You know, again, based on the contract, this multi-year deal, I believe it was 3 years, not all guaranteed, of course, but, you know, that tells me that he is going to be a long-term fixture. And I think that I don't want to say just right off the bat that it kind of spells the end for Younghoe Koo in Atlanta, but I do think that it probably, you know, I think he's got some work to cut out for him to make this team. And listen, I think that's what fans wanted, you know, coming off that season where he was obviously very disappointing and cost the team at least one game. You know, you didn't want to see complacency in that area. So I think a lot of fans are initially enthused by seeing the Falcons make this move.
Well, and let me correct me or jump in where I get this wrong, but just from reading it, he's a German kicker, right?
Right.
He is a part of some international program that the NFL has with international players. And he was the first individual workout that he had was with the Falcons. The Falcons signed him immediately afterwards.
Right.
So, I mean, to me, at the very least, that means they like him more than just a, hey, who knows kind of thing. And obviously on the on the heels of Younghoe Koo having the season that he had last year, like, I don't know. If it works out, great. That's fun. It seems like a risk worth taking, though.
Yeah, I think definitely. So every team now, this was a newly instituted kind of rule or policy or whatever you call it, that came into play, you know, sometime in the last 5 years. And it's this international development player. Like, every team gets to, you know, have one player on their roster, whether that's practice squad or main squad, but usually it's a practice squad player that's like a developmental player. And I believe that's what he's been kind of tagged under. And I believe that gives them some breaks in terms of the, you know, the cost against the cap or whatever, because they want to increase the amount of international players. Actually, OCU Mignora is the Giants, old Giants defensive end, is working with the Falcons as kind of one of their scouts for developing or finding these kinds of talents from international countries. And so I know they had a guy from somewhere in Africa, I believe last year, who's a defensive end, who's like this super tall guy. I think it's interesting. It allows teams to take some shots on some of these players. Obviously, this kicker, Lenny Craig, he was, you know, I think one of the reasons the Falcons gave him the contract they did, as it was reported, was because there was so much competition from other teams to sign him. And so the Falcons really wanted to secure him. But I think it's a great kind of rule in general where it gives teams a chance to kind of develop some players that have some unique traits, whether it's, you know, being super fast or, like, I know this guy, I didn't never really talk to him last year, but he's like the super tall guy. And, you know, and obviously that didn't pan out, but, you know, I think it's an interesting tool for teams to use to try and develop their rosters.
Don't forget OCU Mignora's years here too. 7.5 sacks as a Falcon.
That's right.
JP, anything to read into the restructuring of the contracts that Falcons just did with Lindstrom and AJ?
I don't think so. I believe that this was just a matter of compliance to get them. And listen, like, they've got some salary cap room now, but that allows them to sign their rookie class, which, you know, they're going to have to do here in about a month or so after they, you know, have the draft. And so, to me, this is not sort of a sign that there's any sort of big move on the horizon. To me, this is just, you know, kind of getting their cards in order and their house in order and just kind of being ready. And listen, there will be more free agency signings. I'm quite confident of that happening. And yeah, I think so. Yeah. Okay. I think there'll be another wave of, you know, free agency movement around the league after the draft, because when you come out of the draft, then teams are able to assess what they were able to fill, the needs they were able to fill in the draft, where they still need some help. And there were also some other things, like, you know, this was brought to my attention, but, you know, David Onyemata, apparently, you know, one of the reasons why he might still be on this roster is because he was not allowed to be designated as a post June 1 cut because his roster was, or his contract was already restructured in the middle of the season last year. And so the Falcons have to wait. Yeah. So that's a big thing. So, so I believe, like, he will be released, and there could be other players that are released, still later on in this postseason. Don't get me wrong, I don't think that there's anything major on the horizon, but I do think the Falcons, with the money that they freed up, just gives themselves a little bit more room to operate and be able to capitalize if there are some players that hit the market.
All right, Joe, we don't have much time, but I do want to get your thoughts. What do you need to see from Atlanta United against New York?
So I've really been scrutinizing this team. I've been, like, diving into tape and really trying to look. And
Hell yeah.
And honestly, like, I don't see a lot that is, like, massively wrong. I think they're just falling off. I talked to Ronnie Dyla about this yesterday. Just the load levels, he said, are kind of really affecting the team right now, and that's why they're kind of falling off in some of these second halves. They're just not as fit as they will be in a month or so. Soccer is one of those sports where you kind of grow into your fitness, and you're kind of at prime. You don't really hit your total fitness level until you're a couple months into the season. So I think that will help. But ultimately, I think that this team is playing generally well enough. I think they're probably as good as the results they've gotten so far. But I think that, you know, these are going to be really important games. They've got three home games coming up. I think like 9 points is probably what you should be taking at a minimum. 7 points, like two wins and a draw out of these three. So it'll be a big test for this team, but I think it's only a matter of time before this attack kind of the dam breaks a little bit and some of these goals start to flow.
I hope that you are right. Joe, thank you.
Appreciate it, JP.
Have a great weekend.
All right. You guys too. See ya.
Smoking Joe Patrick there, 92.9 The Game, Falcons reporter, also Atlanta United as well.
He's Quinn Snyder on the middle of a road trip. He's not even in Atlanta this week, and he joins us on Sports Radio 92.9. Coach, good morning. How you doing, sir?
Good morning, guys. Doing okay, thanks.
It's a weird time of year for a NBA fan. You know, the playoffs last for months. We've been watching you guys for, I don't know, 4 months now. I mean, I know you're playing for seeding and everything else, and I'm not saying you like losing in Miami last night, but I call it the dog days of the NBA. I mean, how do you get these guys keep the motor running? I know you can do it for the playoffs, but does it start to feel a little long for everybody by this time of the year?
You know, I think there's two times where you get some of this, and you just kind of the other one's like late January, and you're kind of waiting for All-Star break or anticipating that. And then right now, I think some of it's just as you mentioned, you know, there's so much enthusiasm about the playoffs. But I think the thing for us is obviously, you know, we're in a position where we're probably not going to be one of the, you know, the sixth seed. And then you're looking at the rest of the play-in tournament, so to speak, and what can we do to give ourselves the best opportunity, you know, to come out of there as a 7 or 8 seed. And really the thing that we've tried to stay focused on is just improving. And I think we've got a team because of, you know, we've almost had 3 or 4 different iterations of the same Hawks. You know, we don't have Jalen Hunt, CC, but a lot of these guys that we started the year with. And what the reason I mention that is because some of the new guys that we have and some of the young players that we have that I think have gotten better, the challenge is to continue to try to come together and raise our level. And I think that's in addition to the actual seating itself and home court and those things, I think that needs to be our focus because, as you said, such a different variance in competitiveness. Miami went through a huge, really tough stretch, and, you know, they're playing well. You know, we're going to play a Knicks team coming up that's playing well. And then we've got some other games that are actually tough games, but they're very different games.
Yeah. Quinn Snyder, head coach of the Hawks, joining us on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game.
Coach, I always talk about the NBA's the top athletes in the world. I do football for a living. I cover it, and I see it from, you know, youth up. But when you go see an NBA game and you see how athletic these guys are and how big, they're truly one percentile athletes. Saying that, Dyson Daniels every single night has to guard the best player on the other team, always a super freaky athlete. Tell me why, and I'll tell you my agree with it, why he should win the Defensive Player of the Year, because every single night he has the toughest draw.
You know, I think it's a no-brainer, to be honest with you. And you hear a lot of the different arguments, and I can give you a few more, but I'll comment on what you said, which I think is something that's really interesting and something that I haven't maybe given as much weight to. You know, rim protectors are help defenders for the most part. And, you know, you don't see those guys having to guard one-on-one on the post. There just isn't that much post-up basketball anymore. In Dyson's case, to your point, he's got the best player on the floor every night. And, you know, it was hero last night. And one of the things that when you watch us, it's interesting because teams spend a lot of time on offense literally trying to get him off that guy.
Right.
Yeah. You know, like they're basically
saying, run screen, run screens, run interference, run whatever you can to get him away from the ball.
Get him away from the ball.
Yeah.
Play pick and roll and have him switch onto someone else. So they're actually trying to avoid him.
Mm.
And so now he is off the ball. And he's managed to still be effective in all those situations. But, you know, the fact that the steals things are just ridiculous, guys, right? I mean, what he's doing, stealing the basketball.
Right.
Like,
yeah. Just explain that for a second. I try to say, dude, the Dyson Daniels steal numbers are just ludicrous. Forget about deflections, which is a whole nother ridiculous stat.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's almost too many high watermarks to go through them all.
Right.
I can't remember them, you know, most in 30 years, most by any, like, it's crazy.
Yeah.
I mean,
I've never seen a disruptor on another side of the court where you game plan like you just said. I was like, dude, every time I go watch him live, it's like he's in the middle of every single possession. He's wreaking, wreaking havoc for the other team.
No, he finds ways when they're avoiding him to include himself. Here's one thing that I don't think people are as aware of, is there's a stat they call stocks. And what it is, it's real simple, it's steals and blocks. So not only does he lead the league in steals, he leads the league in steals and blocks combined. So whoever the block leader is, they're not stealing the ball. Our guy is stealing the ball, and he's blocking shots. The last time someone did that as a guard, it was Michael Jordan. Just to put it in a little bit of perspective.
God.
Yeah, back in the you know, back in the 80s.
Yeah, Quinn Snyder with us. As we talk awards, do you think Zach Risacher should be Rookie of the Year?
You know what? If people voted in December, you know, the answer would have been no. The answer would have been he's having a really good season. What he's done, I think, is unbelievably significant because he's still 19. Like, he hasn't turned 20 yet. And the way that he's tracked, the way that he's finishing, the biggest thing with Zach that's different than the other rookies is he's playing on a team that's competing, you know, and it's going to be a postseason team. That's unique because he's not playing as many minutes at times. It's not about just his development. It's about his development within the context of the team and how can he help the team win. And what we're seeing is his numbers and his efficiency continue to track up, and he's responsible for winning. Now, in some, you know, he's also responsible at times when he doesn't play well and we don't win.
Well, yeah.
Which is a whole other layer.
Well,
a
few of our hosts were fired up the other day, because they want to see him in there. I think it was the Houston game. You put him; he wasn't playing in crunch time, or you know, you don't play him all the time in that scenario. You know, the fans are like, "Dude, that's our guy. That's our rookie. Why is he not out there all the time?"
Well, you know, I'm playing the guys that I think can help us win the game at the end of the game.
Yeah,
and this is one of the great. This is the interesting thing about our team because, you know, what do we want to do? Do we want to develop our young guys and not worry about winning? Or do we want to win and not worry about developing our young guys?
I want to do both at the same time. I want to win with our young guys.
Oh, by the way, he's 19.
Yeah. No, I know.
By the way, he's still 19.
So finding how that intersection occurs. And the good thing about Zach, you know, is that's been happening. And, you know, when you have someone that's shooting the shit out of the ball, pardon my language, and he is too, you know, it's easy.
Yeah.
But there are nights when he looks 19 and he's working through that, and I think he has finished the last couple games, you know, in a row. And the development component for us is happening, guys. We start three guys that are in the 19 or their early 20s. That's just not happening out there. And I think the big thing for Zach is playing minutes, and he's up 25, 30 minutes a game.
I think it'll be awesome. Let's get out of the 7-8, get to a playoff series. Oh, a 7-8, we're going to be in the series in that scenario. And let him feel like a Cleveland or Boston matchup on the road and 18,000 people in playoff basketball, because that's totally different. So let those young guys at least feel it tangible how different playoff basketball is. Not just one. not just one game or two games.
And that is the intersection that we talked about. And I think Zach has to feel some of the physicality, and he always responds to that. You know, he always responds to that, and that's been, you know, an impressive thing because, you know, he's going to gain weight. He's going to get stronger. But no amount of protein shakes right now can get him to, you know, 225.
I don't know if you've heard.
That's going to happen later.
Yeah.
Chip, are you there?
I'm here.
Are you a foodie? Are you a restaurateur, or do you fancy
the
nice places?
Do you get excited about going to certain restaurants?
I do, mostly over steak, but I'd probably put Italian a close second. Yeah.
Did you have four or five places? I'm sure you did, on the road that you looked forward to, that you got to know folks there, that it was part of the ritual of your career, like love rolling through Chicago, New York, whatever it was, and just, you know, literally looking forward to some of your favorite places.
Without a doubt, Chicago was definitely at the top of the list. Ron's of Japan was kind of a staple.
Okay.
For most of the guys. We would get off the bus in Chicago and everybody would make a mad dash to Ron's of Japan, but you know, there's so many good places in Chicago. You could eat a different place every night and not hit the same place twice in a year. Philadelphia was Del Fresco's, gorgeous Del Fresco's restaurant that was actually in an old bank. And they had a really cool private area set up in the vault, actually.
In the vault.
So it was really a really cool place. And then Mastro City Hall in when we went to Phoenix. I think it was actually in Scottsdale. But, yeah, everybody kind of made a mad dash to those places. Yeah. And those were probably three that come to the top of mind.
Mastro Scottsdale is a beautiful restaurant. Let me ask you, was early in your career, 10 Braves at the bar, no worries, cell phones aren't around, guys bonding, having cocktails, all that, which is the last thing in the world you're ever going to see now in professional sports. But were you in an era where that's – I mean, I'm not talking about Billy Martin out every night with Mickey Mantle going crazy, but was there that camaraderie and was there lack of fear that, you know, somebody's going to say or get spotted or any of that stuff?
No, there was definitely that kind of dynamic chemistry, if you will. Heck, we used to hang out with the broadcasters.
With Sandra. You know, Sandra was there a few times.
Don't put my business out there, Chipper. Now, come on, y'all. This is between you and steak.
I'm not throwing anybody's dirty laundry out there. But I was, you know, just kind of talking about Joe and Skip and Don. I mean, getting the swap stories. And those conversations started on the plane. You know, where they would just get on a roll and it would just carry over to the, you know, hotel bar. And it was so much fun interacting with those guys. And it gives them a little insight into what's going on in your life. It provides more content for the telecast. So I'm sure, you know, it was entertainment value for us, but it was not only entertainment value for them, but it was also, you know, doing a little homework as well.
Yeah, humanizes the player a little for the broadcaster, but it certainly creates a different energy. I think it creates a different energy with your teammates as well, which, you know, everybody's their own corporation a lot of times now. You get off to your hotel room and, you know, you're isolated and, you know, it's just, and you can't trust with cell phones and everything else. You just can't trust anything, really.
Well, it did change throughout the years. You know, early on in my career, it might be four or five guys that go out, bunch of different cliques, you know, bunch of different people hanging out in their own demographic, their own groups and whatnot. But man, like the last year or two that I was in the league, we would run 15 plus deep to these restaurants. I mean, just an incredibly tight unit. I think they brought me along just because they knew that I was going to foot the bill.
Yeah.
But, you know, with all the
all the, you know, baby Braves, man, they were so close and tight knit. And, you know, myself and Eric Hinsky and Tim Hudson, David Ross, we all got along with all those young kids. And
yeah.
So we were running 15 deep.
You've said before you are a nicer person later in your career, that you had, you know, you were wound very tight, and it took young players and a little more perspective later on in your career to be like more approachable in the locker room, more accessible, maybe less wound up. So you still stand by that evolution of your career and your personality?
I think a bunch of different things go into it. You know, I could say the same thing. You know, Bobby Cox was wound a little tight, you know, through the middle part of my career. And as things wound down for him, you saw him let his hair down. You saw him enjoy interactions with players a little more. For me, you know, a lot of stuff going on off the field that directly correlated to how I interacted with people.
Yeah.
Certainly there towards the end of my career, I was a lot happier in my personal life, which, you know, led to me letting people in. Look, when I walked into that clubhouse, yeah, I wanted to be liked, but I was really focused on who I was facing that night and doing everything I could do to win that game. And, you know, it's unfortunate maybe that rubbed people the wrong way. But I can't say that I wouldn't really change it. I know that whenever a teammate asked me for help or asked me for some sort of guidance, I was there to give it to them. And I gave them my utmost attention. So, if they say I wasn't that friendly, okay, I can live with it. We won a lot of baseball games, and I helped along the way.
Yeah, you did pretty well. Chipper Jones with us, Hall of Famer on Sports Radio 92.9 The Game. You were just at the spring training. Obviously, I see you at the ballpark a bunch. There's a lot of moments you're around. Is there one particular time where you most feel like I missed the game? I know Magic Johnson said, I don't miss the playing as much as the bus rides and everything else, which I, you know, whatever, that may be part of it. But do you start getting that longing on opening day when everybody's running out? Do you get it in the late innings when you're watching a game and you're there and you say, that would be awesome? Do you get it at spring training, or do you not really get it much at all?
I get it like opening day. I get it first game of the playoffs. And I wonder what it would be like to do that and to be a part of that again. But then I realized that I got to wake up the next morning and do it all over again. And that does not appeal to me. I do miss the camaraderie with the fellas. I think I still have my foot in the door to be able to go into the clubhouse and hang out with the guys anytime I want, to be able to go in and help them in the cage anytime I want, to go to spring training and get to know the new guys that are coming in. Had some great sessions down in Florida with Jurickson Profar, who is a switch hitter and had so many questions, just acting like a sponge down there, and really had some good interactions with him and Marcelo Ozuna, who's having another great spring, and I think it's going to have another great year. So, yeah, sitting around and talking the mental part of the game with Olson and Riley, I mean, all those things are stuff that I'm passionate about, and I still get chill bumps whenever those guys have kind of a aha light bulb moment. And that's kind of what we live for as instructors.
What would a guy in his car driving around right now, Chipper Jones with us on Sports Radio 92.9, give us something from your few days there of like watching Olson in the cage or seeing something from Riley or just a couple of things that would just be cool for somebody here as you under, like what you just said about Jerks and Profar on the switch hitting, or right. I think you once said Acuna, it comes off the bat sounding different than anything you've ever seen. Give us a couple of things for a guy driving around that would love to hear.
Or a girl.
Yeah, just to expound upon what Jerickson and I talked about, you know, he natural right-handed hitter, could fall out of bed and hit right-handed But it was funny because he came up and he asked me, he goes, how did you hit the cutter? And I was like, that's a good question because I freaking couldn't hit the cutter to save my life. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't know how to hit the cutter. So we sat there and we talked about it. And, I was talking about they were taking curve balls off the machine. And I was like, you see that ball coming into you and you want to pull it, but more times than not, you're going to come around it, hit a ground ball to first or second. So why don't we concentrate on staying inside the ball no matter where it is on the plate, and we're going to try and stay inside of it and drive it to left center. Well, it took him, three or four pitches where it kind of came around it, but then he got the feel of staying inside of it. He laced about four or five bullets to left center field. And, he's just got this huge bright smile, that he possesses. Just super nice guy. He turns around to me and his eyes were so big and he was smiling so big that he had that aha light bulb moment where, okay, I got, I get the feel of it now. And wow, and so it was just one of those times that I was like, that's how it's done right there. And he goes out. He got three hits that day, or he got two hits. He got robbed of a homer in left center field on an off-speed pitch. But it's those kind of instant results that kind of keep me coming back. This club, in years past has said World Series or bust and whatnot. How about we go healthy 162, or bust? Last year was bust. It's time for us to stay healthy. Yeah. Acuna looks great, swinging the bat great. You've seen Strider come back with a couple of good starts here in spring training. He won't be long before he's back. And let's stay healthy, be hot at the right time in October, and we'll let the chips fall where they may.
You talk about this lineup, and you're the best guy to ask because I covered you with Gary Sheffield, and we covered you with Fred McGriff and Ron Gann, Andrew Jones, every kind of great lineup. But I would imagine you say healthy. If this lineup is healthy for 162, is this as prolific as anything you've seen in terms of guys putting nine guys out there?
Yeah, I think so. I think we had one lineup, I believe, maybe in 98, maybe Galarraga deep. We had seven guys. 20 homers plus. This one is probably deeper because it possesses a DH, and we had
a good point.
Smoltz, Glavine, and Maddox hitting in the nine hole. So they're up 1-0 there. It is what it is. We had some really good lineups back in the day, but this one, when healthy, has a chance to do some special things. You have MVP candidates, you got 40-70 guys, you've got 40-50 homer guys, you've got guys that have contended for triple crowns in the middle. It can be special when it's clicking on all cylinders. We got to get them all in the lineup at the same time.
Where are you watching the game tomorrow, or you got daddy stuff?
Yeah, I've got baseball games. I will probably catch the end of it, but I will be keeping track of it on my phone as I answer about the suburbs of Atlanta.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Real quick. You own part of that team that won it last night for Atlanta, the TGL team, or not?
I guess you could say that. A very small portion. Not as much as Mr. Blank. Let's put it that way.
So
I went down last week. Wow, what a facility that place is. Got a chance to meet the players. And
how sick is that place? How sick is that place?
It's like an indoor facility for the Falcons or, one of the top-notch college football teams. It's huge. The electronics are outstanding. It's a great thing. So happy for the guys, too. They were behind most of the night and then came back in dramatic fashion. Billy Horschel with a big putt, former Gator. It was fun to watch.
I know we got to go. Walter Clayton Jr., is he your new guy after what the Gators did over the weekend, taking care of Danny Hurley?
Yeah, anything to get Danny Hurley off my TV is a good thing. Thank you to Walter Payton Jr.
Yeah.
You know, on those 6'10" and 7-footers that Florida's got, man, they're deep. They're good. Hopefully they can keep it rolling.
They're loaded, but that was as clutch as it gets. Coming off those screens, dude, just hammered those 2 threes.
Yeah.
Anyway, Chipper, thanks for being on with us, and thanks for not sharing Sandra's secrets. He was very respectful
hurtful.
About that.
And I just, hey, did you watch a little FSU-Florida baseball this weekend? Or we got to go, because I think it was a beatdown, Chipper. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I don't. No comment.
Thanks, buddy.
You're
Chipper
the best.
Jones.
Thanks.
Talk soon.
You ever tell anybody that you're going to ruin their life, B.A.?
No, I don't know that I have, but I do really like the fact that Danny Hurley has emerged, obviously out of the tournament now, but, like, you know, college basketball is sort of about the coaches, and it feels like Hurley's kind of got the personality, young enough guy. You know, he may be kind of emerging as a little bit bigger star here, which I don't think is bad for the sport overall.
Yeah, kind of one of the, you know, bad boy characters or something like that. I don't know. I mean, obviously his teams have been really, really good, so that helps. A lot of the conversation out of the first weekend has been the impact of the NIL and the portal and the death of Cinderella and all that kind of stuff. Sounds a lot like conversations we've had about college football. What has been your reaction to some of that?
Yeah, see, my biggest fear about college athletics overall, because you're right, some of this does remind you of what football is I think the unintended consequence of, like, say, NIL transfer portal, the new stuff that we're forced to deal with, is making college athletics smaller. And, look, we're all a little bit of a hypocrite when it comes to the first-round upsets. We like them when they happen.
Mm-hmm.
We like them when they happen, but then historically people sort of tune out in the future rounds when the big school is no longer in there. So I totally acknowledge that. But the one thing that's always felt made March Madness feel really cool to me is the fact the event feels really big. You know, a school from Spokane, Washington, you know, we're talking about Storrs, Connecticut, you know, pretty much stretching the entire country. Everybody sort of feels like they're involved in the tournament. But now that so much of the talent is sort of, once again, congregating in a small number of schools, it sort of makes the NCAA tournament just feel a little bit smaller. And I think college football is kind of the same way. You know, Washington State used to be a major conference power, not a power, but a major conference program. Now they're not. Yeah. You know, Oregon State, now they're not. You know, the unintended consequence of some of what's going on here is just making college athletics a little smaller. And what I don't like about that is it actually impacts the number of opportunities for players, which is technically what all this is supposed to be about.
Yeah, I'd say that, B.A., and I don't know if I think I might have asked you this around football season, but we found out yesterday, me and Andy, I didn't know before yesterday, that it was the transfer portal in basketball. And I was like, well, do you think it'll be a situation where teams who have players whose teams are in the tournament still, where they transfer? Nah, they wouldn't do that. And I'd be damn, B.A., if they're not jumping ship. Are they doing this on purpose? Why do you think that they would have the transfer portal right now for the basketball teams?
Yeah, I mean, like, there have been rumors out there that there have been guys playing the tournament that already had deals to play somewhere else. Yeah. And, you know, it seems like, I guess because there's so many basketball teams, the portal stuff in basketball seems a little crazier. And I'll tell you how that impacts us locally. Okay, so Georgia loses the game to Gonzaga. You know, you'd like to believe, okay, well, it's a successful season because you made the tournament, and now you build off that for the future. But given the fact that we don't have any idea from Georgia's roster who's coming back, who might leave, there are rumors all over the place, whether true or not, that it kind of takes away the one thing that those of us who grew up as sports fans kind of grew up saying, which is, hey, you take the first step 1 year, and you come back and take the second step the next year. But the truth is, I don't care how closely you follow this stuff, you have no idea what Georgia's roster looks like next year, and you probably, you could say that for most of the teams in college basketball. So confusion is never good for fan growth, and I do think there's an element of the transfer portal that creates a level of confusion for fans that I think makes the sport just harder to follow.
There's just something about getting to know a guy over the course of a couple of years as a fan that lends itself to lifelong fanhood. Like, everybody remembers who their favorite guy was when they were rooting for their school when they were a kid. And when it's changing like this, every single, I saw a graphic this morning, BA, where of the 16 teams that are in the Sweet 16, only one of them has a starting five where all the guys started their career at the school. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously wild. And I don't want to turn this like remember when, but, like, you know, if you're about my age, growing up, college basketball felt about as big to me as college football did, because you did have Fab Five staying multiple years. You had those Rick Pitino Kentucky teams where the Duke teams, where you got to know players over the course of 2 and 3 years. This is not new commentary. Everybody said this before, but it's amazing how big that made college basketball feel back then. And now, you know, it's fun for the brackets. A lot of people like to bet on these games, and that's obviously really fun too. But for the depth of passion, though, just can't be there when you don't know the individual personalities nearly as well.
B.A., is this this we were just talking before we got you on. Is this Georgia baseball team better than it was last year? I mean, we saw Washington, they dismantled Florida this past weekend. But so far, do you look at this team maybe better than last year's team?
I tell you this, it's amazing how well they're playing in the post-Charlie Condon era.
Right.
And I'm a little bit of an evangelist for this right now. I think that college baseball is a really fun sport. And in Atlanta, we're always going to be – our sports cards are pretty crowded, right? You know, you got an NBA team, you got kind of two major colleges, you got some other mid-majors, you've obviously got pro football. You know, there's a lot going on here. So college baseball is going to get less attention in our city than it's going to get other places. But if you take your time to invest your time into it, I think it's a ton of fun. And obviously Georgia being better makes that, you know, good for a Georgia fan. But just the sport overall, I think is pretty cool. So Georgia's playing great, just swept Florida. And for people who maybe could have a little bit more room for some more sports in their life, I would encourage them to give college baseball a try. I think it's a really fun sport.
Hey, B.A., I wish that this was a like a new topic or a new question, but it isn't. More driving incidents with Georgia football players last week.
Yep.
Do you have a new thought on it? Like, is you know, it sort of continues to happen. What was your reaction to that from last week?
Yeah, all I can do is sort of share my honest opinion, which is when all we're talking about is the guy driving too fast, the truth is I don't care that much about that. Or when so-and-so goes the wrong way in a downtown street, once again, I sort of shrugged that off. But the allegations that have been levied against Marcus Easley, I find that to be a pretty serious situation. I know the people inside the Georgia building know that. I know they're working hard to try to remedy it. I don't know what the solution is. But when you're talking about a situation where a car allegedly loses control in a small apartment complex, hits two other cars, keeps going, and then hits one of the doors of one of the apartments,
mm-hmm.
Now we're talking about more than just speeding, and now we're talking about more than just a driving incident. I feel like the Easley allegations are far more serious. So I don't get into the, well, it's been 24 or whatever the actual number is. I don't get that much into it, but as a very pro-Georgia person, I was very disturbed by the allegations from Marcus against Marcus Easley last week.
No doubt about that, B.A. And obviously the suspension, indefinite suspensions come down for both young men. One last one for me, B.A., and, you know, because it has not been officially official, but do you think there will be a G-Day game, B.A.? I mean, it'll be something, but it won't be like that.
Yeah, so if, for a while I was sort of thinking maybe they were trending just not to have one, period. Now I don't really quite think that as much anymore. I think it's going to be modified. I don't think it's going to look as much like real football as it has in the past. So I think they're going to still have it. But as far as, like, you know, start talking about, like, 2026 and stuff like that, your guess is as good as mine. But I think it's still on to be had. It may just not quite look the way that it's looked in the past. If nothing else, there's a chance the five-star quarterback Jared Curtis may come. So if he's going to be there, they're going to have a game. but I'm just not exactly sure what it's going to look like.
Jared's going to be there.
Jared's going to be there.
Get out there and snap him up, guys.
Who's he?
He's five-star quarterback from Nashville. He's going to be announcing his commitment on May the 5th.
Okay.
It's either Georgia or Oregon.
Oh.
And the price tag is probably, you know, mid-seven figures at this point in time. So we'll see. We'll see how the bidding war plays out.
That's an easy pick. I picked Georgia over Oregon.
Of course you'd
like to think so.
I lived in Portland. I was like, I'm coming here.
UW, man.
Yeah, I mean, yeah,
exactly. B.A.
Well, no, I have no dog in the fight. I mean, as far as that goes. Kirby had some money quotes last week, as he often does. I loved when he talked about guys being offended by hard work. What did you make of some of what he was saying at the end of spring practice last week?
I like it. I mean, it was a very spirited day. There were like seven players that were interviewed, so it was a really spirited day. And look, I believe that coaching still matters. For as much as we pay players and as much as, like, the sport sort of serves the needs of players now, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but it's become a very pro-player mindset in college football right now. I think the role of coaches is still important, and sometimes that means hard coaching.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that the Georgia coaches are kind of drawing a hard line on that stance, I actually, in a roundabout way, think that probably suggests something pretty good about Georgia in the near term and the long term. I think it's nice to have a coach stand up for the role of coaching, and this is more than just –
a bidding war to acquire raw talent, that we're actually going to try to shape the talent that comes into the program. I think Kirby Smart saying that's probably a pretty good thing.
B.A., we appreciate it, as always.
Appreciate you, B.
Always good to be with you guys. Yeah, thanks a lot.
Now let's talk to John Smoltz. He is the national analyst for Fox and, of course, one of the all-time great Braves. It's good to have on. As always, Smoltzy, we love talking with you, man. You know, a lot of conversation about what the Dodgers and the Mets have done. And I tweeted it out today and said, look, I am not concerned with that. I think the Braves have a really good club. And I'm curious to know where you're at when you look at the Braves. We know Strider's coming back. We know Acuna at some point is going to be back. But I love our lineup. And I think the fact that we didn't spend $700 million doesn't discount that this team won't be a contender.
Agree. The other teams have made themselves better, and they were playoff teams. Yes, last year, and how they came back from the dead on paper would make them feel like they're much better and much more primed for a long run. But a lot of money in one area of a ball club that still has some weaknesses in their starting rotation with the health of it. And this is the way I think when I look at a season and I see how it unfolds. What is the identity of your club, and can you get back to it? And the identity of the Atlanta Braves has been, in the last few years, their offense, the dynamic offense. It starts with Acuna, so it's like getting another free agent back. If he can be healthy and just be 75% of what he's capable of doing, the Braves lineup, which had its issues last year because of so many injuries, was not the same team. The pitching staff is going to be good enough. The starting staff is really, really good. And again, like everything else, it's a broken record. If they stay, there's no doubt that the Braves are going to be in the mix, are going to compete in what is going to be the, probably the most competitive division in all of baseball. It's top heavy, and it comes down to taking advantage of those teams in your schedule and winning those games and just hoping to go 500 against the Mets and the Phillies.
John, you had Tommy John, had 9 great years after that. Strider, it wasn't a full Tommy John because it was more lower arm, but how do you get back in the mix? Strider, by the way, looked amazing in his starts in spring training.
Yeah, I think that the downside for Spencer is the fact that there's so much expected of him. Of course, he throws 100 miles an hour, which I think can be a downfall because to me, it's a false sense of security when analytics tells you can throw the ball right down the middle and you have an unhittable fastball, which he does. This is what I think, though. What happens when you don't have that electric life? And what we've seen in the past is he's been a little bit more susceptible to the home run ball and shorter outings. I wish, you know, for his sake, that he didn't feel like he had to throw 100 every time and could pitch to quadrants and really utilize what is a special stuff. I tell people all the time, and we had 36 starts every year, and I'll bet you 18 to 20 of them, we might have had our electric stuff. We might have had, I might have had my late life fastball. In the other 16 or so, you got to figure out how to get by, and you got to figure out how to navigate when you don't have your best stuff. Today, it's a little bit different. They want the best stuff all the time. So to answer that fairly, it's going to take a month or two. Because he's going to look unhittable, which he is when he's on. It's just a gift. But then there's going to be moments post-Tommy John or even post this surgery that you're not connected with your mechanics and your fastball and your stuff. We always say that hitters can time a train if you give them enough chances to hit a fastball moving like a train. But I think the biggest thing is a well-placed pitch is always the best next option. And we'll just see how that affects his command. But we all know he's already proven what he can do when he's healthy.
Hall of Famer John Smoltz here on Dukes and Bell, opening day for our Braves as we talk about a variety of things. We'll go around baseball here in a sec. Smoltzy, you know, Austin Riley was talking about getting his stick back and getting his rhythm back. Obviously, he lost a guy that was close to him in a tragic accident, and he's discussed that. And I'm curious to know, you know, that's a guy that we're counting on, and Olsen as well, to produce those runs like they did just a few years ago. We know everybody was dealing with injuries last year, but give me your thoughts on Riley and him bouncing back.
Well, what I love about Austin Riley's resume is he's been there, done that. He's gone through the peak in his brief entrance to the big leagues, set the world on fire, and then he went through a really tough spot. And when a guy gets out of a tough spot early in his career, he knows how to get out of it. It's not foreign to him. We have the youngest, most dynamic athletes in the game ever, but they're not given the priority of struggling. They're not really taught how to play through ups and downs. And when you have a young man that goes through it like he did, it impressed the heck out of me. That's why I knew that contract was worth its salt and gold. When you only sign a guy to his first great year, you have no clue what's going to happen when he struggles. I don't care what any numbers or analytics tell you. They have no clue. They are literally flipping a coin. But because Riley did what he did and they had that track record, there is not a moment that he goes through that I would be worried if I was part of the brass of the Atlanta Braves that he's not going to get out of it. And I think he's got the work ethic and the desire to be great, and that's what all you can ask for in a player that's been given a long contract.
John, you've had a lot of great catchers because you got to have a good, obviously, receiver if you're going to do the jobs you do. When Javi was coming up, because we've got Drake Baldwin now getting to the show, how do you help a rookie catcher, and how will he do this year dealing with the pitchers?
Well, it's a little bit different now because they're given so much information and so much at the helm of what their information can be overloaded. I can't imagine what a young catcher has responsibilities for today versus where really it was primarily of a pitcher's game, where we called our own game. We never really had catchers call a game for us. And now, which is even more amazing, that Chris Sale, it's still hard to believe that he's never shook a pitch off in his entire career, is what I've heard. And that, to me, puts a little bit more pressure on a young man that is going to try to take it all in, navigate a game plan. You know, the pitcher-catcher situation is so important, and there's sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I only had one situation ever. I think I threw to 31 or 32 different catchers, some crazy number. Only had one situation that didn't work. And then I got a chance to break in Brian McCann, and it was one of the greatest things I've ever been part of, because not only did we take a picture with him when he was 9 years old, he then became his debut was with me. So wow. Those are fun moments for pitchers. But pitchers aren't in that place anymore where they don't really call their own game. And so that information is being fed to them.
John, what do you think about this Skeens kid? We talk about 300 strikeouts all the time. And look, it's difficult, right? I mean, we don't see pitchers do it all the time. But when they do, it's one of those things where you go, wow, okay. I think the guy could get there. I think Strider, if he had all of his starts this year, could probably do it as well. But Skeens is getting a lot of attention, and I think he's the front runner for the Cy Young so far this year as the season gets underway today.
Well, I mean, listen, the game's different in the philosophy of hitting, so strikeouts are not going to be they're easier to attain. That doesn't take anything away from the dynamic pitching that's out there. But if you're on your game as a pitcher, you're going to strike out a lot of guys because the swing plane is pretty much the same all the way throughout the lineup. And so it's hard to adjust from hitters when you're facing 99, 98 miles an hour in a slider or changeup or whatever the secondary pitches they have. And on the vice versa is if you're not on your game, you're going to give up a lot of home runs for pitching. So, yes, 300 strikeouts is probably more available today than ever before. And it's a combination of the stuff that the guys have, but the style of hitting, too. So when you can do that in less than 200 innings or 210 innings, that's insane. I mean, that just doesn't compute. And you know, not to take anything away from the guys, but there isn't really no two-strike approach. And that's why the all-time average, you know, the average for baseball players has gone way down because analytically they want them to swing for the fences. That's the quickest way to put a run on the board.
That launch angle. I love when John talks. John, when you ever come on the show, I always feel like, yeah, what he said. It's John Smoltz with us, guys. Hall of Famer with us here on the WadeFord.com hotline. You had John Schuerholz as the general manager. Pitching was always the cornerstone. The great farm system, and then augmented with guys like Fred McGriff to Gary Sheffield over the years. It just seems like Alex Anthopoulos will not spend the big money on frontline pitching. And we're going to bat once again with a few question marks. Is that just an acceptable risk because you're taking care of the 1-8?
Yeah, I think the one thing that baseball has not addressed, and I think we're getting closer to it, they just won't address the injury problem. They know there's an injury problem. That's why certain teams aren't going to invest in long-term pitching because they feel like that's a wasted commodity and they can find enough arms to piecemeal it together. And there's two ways to go about it right now. And some teams are building with their young, dynamic offense that has a longer sustainability to them and they can feel like they can outscore and maybe mix and match. I'll tell you what's not possible. What the Braves did 2 years ago is not a recipe of success when they used like 35 pitchers and 17 different starters. Their offense took over for that, right? And then last year you saw where that didn't come into play. So I still believe you got to win with pitching, no doubt. And everyone's looking for it because they've devalued the starting pitching in the general, and they tried to build everything from the back end up, and then they're realizing, well, perfect example, the Los Angeles Dodgers, you know why they loaded up on 25 different starting pitching? Because every one of them get hurt, and their bullpen is so taxed last year that they basically have the resources to do it. I guess good for them. But their arms in the pen, they had to go get different guys, because when you go that long and you win a World Series with only 2.5 starting pitchers, something's going to suffer. So I think the prudent game that we have right now, which it is what it is, it's more of a roll of a dice to spend 7 years on a starting pitcher and hope that you get 3.5 to 4 years. Like, that's not a good bargain. So I hope the Braves find a way to keep those guys healthy. And I'll tell you another thing. We're more going towards a 6- and 7-man rotation than we are to realize that that would be a horrible idea, because now guys like Spencer Strider, give him extra rest. Do you think he's going to back it down, or do you think he's going to throttle it up with extra rest?
Right,
he will
right.
throttle it up. It's actually a reverse output of what you think would be a safer scenario by giving guys more rest.
Hey, Fox National analyst John Smoltz joining us. This is something Mike and I argue about. I want to get your thoughts on it. Where are you at on the salary cap? This offseason we saw, obviously, the Mets spend a lot. The Dodgers. I just had a guy say, the Dodgers always spend. Not like they did this offseason. Top 10 counts for half of all the payroll in baseball. What do you think about a salary cap in baseball? And is it even feasible to think about this happening in the game?
Well, here's what I would say. And for years we were in this boat, and we realized that the game of baseball has a special thing going right now where there's no real dominance in the sense of repeat champions. It's been forever. It's been the Yankees are the last repeat champion. Now, all things point towards the Dodgers, and until the Dodgers break that mold, that what we've seen is the most money doesn't guarantee a championship. It may guarantee you the playoffs, but I think the one thing in our sport that frustrates most fans and frustrates most players, if you're going to go down that road, the biggest problem in our game right now is the teams that don't care and don't spend still don't care and still don't spend.
Right.
So if you don't have a floor, I don't know what a ceiling is going to be able to do. And it, to me, the model case for the team that really has been a most frustrating franchise since 1992 has been the Pittsburgh Pirates. And I think if Pittsburgh can't figure out a way to win, especially with the number of talented players they have now, and they don't decide to spend, that's what I think you end up having an argument where teams that were getting money from these high salary driven teams like the Dodgers are not reinvesting that salary back in, or that money in the salary. And so that's where you have kind of this rubber meets the road. And the biggest problem was the expanded playoffs maybe suppresses that too, because now a team thinks they can get in with a 500 record. And so that's where you have a little bit of that issue going on.
And that's the argument, John, because with the NFL, I mean, salary cap, you know, an Indianapolis or a New Orleans can win a championship. And unless the Rays really hit it hard, you know, with their system really hitting, the A's, the Rays, the Pirates, you pointed out, the Reds, they really have no shot. So, but I guess, can you ever force these owners to sell? And that's never going to happen because you need better owners, basically. John? Did we lose him?
Yeah, you still. Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think the biggest thing is, like, if you all think all the way back to Moneyball, right? Moneyball started with the Oakland A's. And yet, you make a good point. I mean, but they haven't won a series, they haven't won a playoff series. So I think baseball has proven over 162 that, you know, if you do things the right way, and yes, in pockets, you can win if you're a small market team, no doubt. I've been pushing for this for years. We'd have to add two more teams for this to happen. I would love to see a first half, second half winner, and each playoffs have, you know, first half winner and a second half winner, and then you would have competitive balance beyond. Because 162 is a separator. It's a separator with teams that can make. See, I think the fans go, look, the Dodgers can make 10 wrong decisions because they can make 10 bad contracts but survive it with their payroll. The Rays can't make two bad decisions. So it puts a lot of pressure on building your club and taking the window. I hate that word, the window of opportunity to win. Well, what the Braves have done is they've locked up their core players. They've given the fan base here a chance to win for long term. And if they fill the gaps in their deficiencies, they're just fine. So, again, until there's dominance in one area and teams keep dominating the World Series, I don't know how many changes will happen, but I sure know I'd be a struggling fan in some of these small market cities that historically keep getting these great players but don't find a way to put other players together to get them to the chance to win.
Dude, you're the best. We love you, Smoltzy. Have a great year, man. We're looking forward to hearing you, seeing you, and getting you back on the show soon. Where are you starting out, by the way?
I have the Houston Astros and New York Mets on Saturday, so a lot of those storylines will go right along with what we talked about, and it's going to be interesting to see how some of these teams separate themselves. But you know what I love about this time of the year? I wish every city could keep the clippings of their paper in the first 2 weeks when everybody says, this is horrible, we're going to win the World Series. Like, the falling on and off the boat is the most hilarious 2 weeks in baseball history.
It's fun. There's no doubt. Man, thank you so much. Hey, take care. Be safe, and we'll talk to you soon.
You got it, guys. Thanks for having me.